All right, get ready, because our deep dive today takes us into the wild world of music law. We're going deep on Greenfield v. Phillies Records, a case that, well, it really shook up the music industry. It's still making waves today. Just imagine you write a song, it gets huge, and ends up in, like, Dirty Dancing, you
Yeah.
know, a classic. But then, no royalty check. None. That's the Ronettes story.
You know what's really fascinating about this case? It kind of pulls back the curtain on this tension. It's at the heart of a lot of legal battles, especially in creative fields. Basically, how do you take contracts from like forever ago and apply them to, well, technology that's changing constantly?
That's it. That's why this case is still so important, even for those of us who aren't, you know, rock stars. So rewind to 1963. You've got the Ronettes, Be My Baby, one of their big hits. They signed a recording contract with Phil Spector's label, Phillies Records. Seems normal, right? 5 years, a $15,000 advance, the usual royalty stuff. But zoom ahead a few decades, and bam. This contract is a legal hurricane.
Yeah, and hidden in that standard contract, there's this clause. It's a real game changer. It gave Phileas Records total ownership, all the recordings, plus the right to reproduce them. And get this, by any method now or hereafter known, that little phrase, it's huge, especially when you think this was written way before streaming, syncing rights for movies, and all the ways we use music now.
So did the Ronettes actually see any royalties during their time with Phillies?
Nope. Despite all their hits, they just got that initial advance, nothing more. This is a point a lot of artists miss. You sign a contract, doesn't mean you get paid regularly. The payment terms, those are key.
Like the legal version of read the fine print, right? But wait, there's more. Years later, in the 80s, Phillies Records starts licensing those Ronettes songs for movies, TV, compilations, big money coming in. But the group? Nothing.
You got it. But that's when Ronnie Greenfield steps in. She was Veronica Bennett, one of the Ronettes. She sues in 87. Bold move, right? Taking on a contract from another era.
Okay, so we've got this 1963 contract, super broad language about ownership, and then they're using the Ronettes songs in ways no one even dreamed of back then. What did the courts say initially?
Well, the first court, they sided with the Ronettes, award them $3 million, a big chunk of change, and when it went up to the appellate division, they agreed. Upheld the decision.
Case closed, right. Justice served.
Not so fast. Phillies Records and Phil Spector, they weren't done. They appealed it all the way to the top, the New York Court of Appeals. And that's where this case, well, it becomes a landmark. This appeal changes everything. It made everyone stop and think, how do you take a straightforward contract from the 60s and make it work in the 80s and beyond? The Court of Appeals, they reversed everything. They went with Phil's Records. And their reasoning, well, even though that contract didn't specifically say film synchronization, that phrase, you know, granting ownership by any method now or hereafter known, it was just too broad. They said it covers stuff like that. It was a big decision, really made waves in the legal world and, of course, the music industry. Lots of debate.
So wait, even though things like film synchronization, it wasn't even a thing back in 63, the court said that broad language covered it. That's kind of scary. I mean, for any contract dealing with intellectual property, right? Especially now, with technology changing so fast.
Yeah, you got it. This case is a huge lesson. You got to think about the future when you're writing contracts, especially with intellectual property. If the Ronettes contract had spelled things out, you know, or even put limits on certain rights, things might be different.
It's a reminder for everyone,
Yeah.
right? Be careful what you sign. But there's more to this story. Ronnie Greenfield and Phil Spector, they had a divorce settlement back in 74. Didn't that play a role here?
Good catch. Yeah, that adds a whole other layer. See, the 74 settlement had these things called mutual general releases. The idea was to settle everything, past and future claims, between them. Phillies Records, they argued that those releases should have stopped Ronnie Greenfield from even suing in the first place.
So did those releases, like, did they change the outcome of the case?
This is where it gets really interesting. The court, they looked at those releases and they said, yeah, the divorce settlement, it covered money stuff. But it didn't specifically say anything about future royalties from licensing recordings. Basically, even when it's about money, a general release doesn't automatically cover every possible future claim. You gotta be specific, especially when you're talking about giving up rights to money you might make later.
So they signed these releases, but the releases weren't specific enough to cover those future royalties. This is for our listeners out there, the lawyers and law students. What's the takeaway, the big lesson from this part of the case?
It all comes down to being specific, really specific, when you're writing legal stuff. General releases, they don't always prevent future lawsuits, unless, of course, they clearly say those specific claims are covered. The court, they were all about specific language. Lawyers, take note. That should be your guiding principle when you're writing releases, especially ones that deal with future income.
So both the original contract and that divorce settlement, they show how important clear language is, right? And paying attention to the details. But back to the Court of Appeals. Why did they side with Phyllis Records? What was their logic?
They really focused on this idea of unconditional transfers of ownership. Their argument was that 63 contract, when it gave Phyllis Records full ownership, it basically handed over all the rights that came with those recordings, even stuff they hadn't thought of yet, like giving them a blank check.
So it wasn't just what the contract said, but what it didn't say. If it didn't specifically exclude certain uses, the court figured those rights were part of the deal. Wow, that sets a pretty big precedent.
Absolutely. And it's a wake-up call for creators, right? You got to be proactive, lock down your rights, even the ones that seem, I don't know, irrelevant at the time. Think about it. Back in the 60s, no one knew about streaming services or all the ways we use music today.
Makes you wonder, how would this case play out now, you know, with all the digital stuff? Would a court today, looking at a contract from before the internet, would they say ownership rights cover things like streaming or downloads?
That's the million-dollar question. Legal experts, the music industry, they're still debating that one. The Greenfield case, it seems to say, at least in New York, that old broad language, it can still have a lot of power. It's like technology changes, but the core principles of contract law, those are pretty sticky.
This case, it also makes me think about, like, power dynamics. In the music industry, back then, did the Ronettes have, you know, good lawyers?
Mm-hmm.
Lawyers who could have seen these problems coming and gotten them a better deal?
That's a good point. It's something people forget. Having a good lawyer can make all the difference, especially for young artists just starting out. The Greenfield case, it's a reminder. Talent's important, sure, but you gotta understand the business side too, and the legal stuff. It's crucial.
So our deep dive is saying contracts, they're not just static things. They gotta keep up with the times. But for artists and creators today, in this crazy world, what can they actually do to protect themselves?
That's a whole other deep dive right there. But for now, I'd say get yourself a lawyer, one who specializes in intellectual property and entertainment law. Spend the money up front. It could save you a lot of trouble later on.
Good advice. Greenfield v. Phyllis Records, it's not just some old case, right? It's still relevant. It teaches us stuff that's important for anyone who creates, owns, or uses intellectual property. Welcome back, everyone. We've been going deep on Greenfield v. Phyllis Records, and, well, it really makes you think, huh? Sign a piece of paper in your 20s, and it could affect you, like, forever, even decades later.
It's a huge lesson, for sure. And not just for musicians, software people, inventors, writers, anyone who makes intellectual property, really. Greenfield, it's a big red flag. Be proactive. Think about the long game when you're making deals.
Yeah, you got to know where you want your work to go in the future and make sure you're protected every step of the way. But I want to get your take on something. What about the big picture? How has this case, like, changed the music industry overall?
Well, one thing's for sure, it made people pay attention to intellectual property rights, especially for musicians. It was a wake-up call, right? Artists started to get more assertive, negotiating contracts, making sure they own their master recordings. And we saw more organizations pop up, helping artists learn about their rights, you know, giving them the tools to deal with the music business.
So it kind of empowered artists.
Exactly. Greenfield v. Phyllis Records, it pushed artists to get smarter about the business side of things. And it changed the legal game too. Lawyers who really understand copyright, licensing, royalties, they became super important. They help artists get fair deals, deals that protect them.
The impact goes way beyond the courtroom, doesn't it? This awareness, did it change how recording contracts are written, especially now with all the new technology?
Oh yeah, big time. In the digital world, music is everywhere. Streaming, downloads, all kinds of stuff they never imagined in the 60s. Recording contracts had to catch up. You see more specific language now. Digital rights, streaming royalties, those sync licenses. It's not enough to just say ownership by any method anymore. You got to get into the nitty-gritty. How can the music be used? How's the money going to be split? Details, details.
Like the music industry had to learn the hard way, right?
Yeah.
Because of Greenfield v. Phyllis Records. New era, new rules.
Yeah.
Digital distribution changed everything.
Exactly. Those old contracts, they just didn't fit anymore. Now the industry knows. You gotta be clear, be specific, and think about the future when you're making agreements. The digital revolution, it forced everyone to, you know, update their playbook.
All right, as we wrap this deep dive up, one last thought for our listeners. What advice would you give to, I don't know, a new musician or anyone going into a creative field where contracts and intellectual property are involved? What's the one thing they should know?
Knowledge is power, right? Learn as much as you can. Understand your rights. Don't just skim those contracts. Read them carefully. And get a good lawyer. It's worth it. Your creative work, it's valuable. Protect it.
Could have said it better myself. A little bit of knowledge and some prep work can go a long way. It can help you get what you deserve for all your hard work. And that brings our deep dive into Greenfield v. Philly's Records to a close. It's been a trip, right? Exploring the world of music, law, and the digital age.
It really has. It's been great breaking down this case with you. It's complex, but so relevant, even today.
And remember, folks, what we talked about today, it goes way beyond music. These lessons apply to any field where, you know, creativity meets business. Stay informed, stay curious, and keep learning. Until next time.